Chapter 42. Defense of nations expended $1,000,000,000 in the erection of this magnificent dwelling place. Armies were employed, in the intervals of their warlike labors, to level hills, or pile them up, to turn rivers, and to build aqueducts, and transplant woods, and construct smooth terraces, and long canals. A vast garden grew up in a wilderness, and a stupendous palace in the garden, and a stately city round the palace. The city was peopled with parasites, who daily came to do worship before the creator of these wonders, the great king. "Usul est grand," said courtly Massillon. But next to him, as the prelate thought, was certainly Louis, his vicegerent here upon earth, God's lieutenant governor of the world, before whom courtiers used to fall on their knees, and shade their eyes, as if the light of his countenance, like the sun, which shone supreme in heaven, the type of him, was too dazzling to bear. Did ever the sun shine upon such a king before, in such a palace? Or, rather, did such a king ever shine upon the sun? When majesty came out of his chamber, in the midst of his superhuman splendors, viz., in his cinnamon-colored coat, embroidered with diamonds, his pyramid of a wig, asterisk his red-heeled shoes, that lifted him 4 inches from the ground, that he scarcely seemed to touch. When he came out, blazing upon the dukes and duchesses that waited his rising, what could the latter do but cover their eyes, and wink, and tremble? And did he not himself believe, as he stood there, on his high heels, under his ambrosial periwig, that there was something in him more than man, something above fate? Asterisk, it is fine to think that, in the days of his youth, His Majesty Louis XIV used to powder his wig with gold dust. This, doubtless, was he fain to believe. And if, on very fine days, from his terrace before his gloomy palace of St. Germain's, he could catch a glimpse, in the distance, of a certain white spire of St. Denis, where his race lay buried, he would say to his courtiers, with a sublime condescension, "Gentlemen, you must remember that I too, a mortal." Surely the lords-in-waiting could hardly think him serious, and vowed that His Majesty always loved a joke. However, mortal or not, the sight of that sharp spire wounded His Majesty's eyes, and is said, by the legend, to have caused the building of the Palace of Babel Versailles. In the year 1681 then, the great king, with bag and baggage, with guards, cooks, chamberlains, mistresses, Jesuits, gentlemen, lackeys, Fenelons, Molières, Lauzuns, Bossuets, Villers, Villerois, Louvois, Colberts, transported himself to his new palace, the old one being left for James of England and Jacquet his wife, when their time should come. And when the time did come, and James sought his brother's kingdom, it is on record that Louis hastened to receive and console him, and promised to restore, incontinently, those islands from which the canal had turned him. Between brothers such a gift was a trifle, and the courtiers said to one another reverently, "Colon asterisk, Lord said unto my lord, sit thou on my right hand, until I make thine enemies thy footstool." There was no blasphemy in the speech. On the contrary, it was gravely said, by a faithful believing man, who thought it no shame to the latter, to compare His Majesty with God Almighty. Indeed, the books of the time will give one a strong idea how general was this Louis worship. I have just been looking at one, which was written by an honest Jesuit and protege of Pierre Lachaise, who dedicates a book of medals to the August infants of France, which does, indeed, go almost as far in print. He calls our famous monarch Louis le Grand. 1. L'Invincible. 2. Le Sage. 3. Le Conquérant. 4. La Merveille de son siècle. 5. La Terreur de ses ennemis. 6. L'Amour de ses pupils. 7. L'Arbiter de la Paix et de la Guerre. 8. L'Admiration de l'Universe. 9. A d'indenetter le Mater. 10. Le Model d'un Heroes Achieve. 11. Din de l'Immortalite, et de la Veneration de tous les siècles. Asterisk, I think it is in the amusing memoirs of Madame de Crequy a forgery, but a work remarkable for its learning and accuracy, that the above anecdote is related. A pretty Jesuit declaration, truly, and a good honest judgment upon the great king. In 30 years more won. The invincible had been beaten a vast number of times. 2. The sage was the puppet of an artful old woman, who was the puppet of more artful priests. 3. The conqueror had quite forgotten his early knack of conquering. 5. The terror of his enemies, for the marvel of his age, we preterm it, it being a loose term that may apply to any person or thing, was now terrified by his enemies in turn. 6. The love of his people was as heartily detested by them as scarcely any other monarch, not even his great-grandson, has been, before or since. 7. The arbiter of peace and war was fain to send superb ambassadors, to kick their heels in Dutch shopkeepers' ante-chambers. 8 is again a general term. 9. The man fit to be master of the universe was scarcely master of his own kingdom. 10. The finished hero was all but finished, in a very commonplace and vulgar way. And 11. The man worthy of immortality was just at the point of death, without a friend to soothe or deplore him, only withered old maintenance, to utter prayers at his bedside, and croaking Jesuits to prepare him, asterisk with heaven, knows what wretched tricks and mummeries, for his appearance in that great republic, that lies on the other side of the grave. In the course of his fourscore splendid miserable years, he never had but one friend, and he ruined and left her. Poor La Valliere, what a sad tale is yours! Look at this Galerie des Glaces, cries Monsieur Vadout, staggering with surprise at the appearance of the room, 242 feet long, and 40 high. Here it was that Louis displayed all the grandeur of royalty, and such was the splendor of his court, and the luxury of the times, that this immense room could hardly contain the crowd of courtiers that pressed around the monarch. Wonderful! Wonderful! 8,460 square feet of courtiers. Give a square yard to each, and you have a matter of 3,000 of them. Think of 3,000 courtiers per day, and all the chopping and changing of them for near 40 years. Some of them dying, some getting their wishes, and retiring to their provinces to enjoy their plunder, some disgraced, and going home to pine away out of the light of the sun. Asterisk asterisk new ones perpetually arriving, pushing, squeezing, for their place, in the crowded Galerie des Glaces. A quarter of a million of noble countenances, at the very least, must those glasses have reflected. Rouge, diamonds, ribbons, patches, upon the faces of smiling ladies. Towering periwigs, sleek-shaven crowns, tufted mustaches, scars, and grizzled whiskers, worn by ministers, priests, dandies, and grim old commanders. So many faces, O ye gods! And every one of them lies. So many tongues, vowing devotion and respectful love to the great king in his 6-inch wig. And only poor La Valliere's amongst them all which had a word of truth for the dull ears of Louis of Bourbon. Asterisk they made a Jesuit of him on his deathbed. Asterisk asterisk Saint Simon's account of Lauzun, in disgrace, is admirably facetious and pathetic. Lauzun's regrets are as monstrous as those of Raleigh, when deprived of the sight of his adorable queen and mistress, Elizabeth. Quan jori de la peine aux Carmelites, says unhappy Louis, about to retire from these magnificent courtiers, and their grand Galerie des Glaces, Jimmy Salviendri de C.K.S. Gens La Montfait Souffer. A troop of Bossuets inveighing against the vanities of courts could not preach such an affecting sermon. What years of anguish and wrong had the poor thing suffered, before these sad words came from her gentle lips. How these courtiers have bowed and flattered, kissed the ground on which she trod, fought to have the honor of riding by her carriage, written sonnets, and called her goddess, who, in the days of her prosperity, was kind and beneficent, gentle and compassionate to all. Then, on a certain day, when it is whispered that his majesty hath cast the eyes of his gracious affection upon another, behold 3,000 courtiers are at the feet of the new divinity. Divine Athanase! What blockheads have we been to worship any but you? That a goddess? A pretty goddess forsooth. A witch, rather, who, for a while, kept our gracious monarch blind. Look at her. The woman limps as she walks, and, by sacred Venus, her mouth stretches almost to her diamond earrings. Asterisk, asterisk, the same tale may be told of many more deserted mistresses, and fair Athenais de Montespan was to hear it of herself one day. Meantime, while La Valliere's heart is breaking, the model of a finished hero is yawning, as, on such paltry occasions, a finished hero should. Let her heart break. A plague upon her tears and repentance. What right has she to repent? Away with her to her convent. She goes, and the finished hero never sheds a tear. What a noble pitch of stoicism to have reached. Our Louis was so great, that the little woes of mean people were beyond him. His friends died, his mistresses left him, his children, one by one, were cut off before his eyes, and great Louis is not moved in the slightest degree. As how, indeed, should a god be moved? Asterisk, a pair of diamond earrings, given by the king to La Valliere, caused much scandal, and some lampoons are extant, which impugn the taste of Louis XIV, for loving a lady with such an enormous mouth. I have often liked to think about this strange character in the world, who moved in it, bearing about a full belief in his own infallibility, teaching his generals the art of war, his ministers the science of government, his wits taste, his courtiers dress, ordering deserts to become gardens, turning villages into palaces at a breath, and indeed the august figure of the man, as he towers upon his throne, cannot fail to inspire one with respect and awe. How grand those flowing locks appear, how awful that scepter, how magnificent those flowing robes. In Louis, surely, if in anyone, the majesty of kinghood is represented. But a king is not every inch a king, for all the poet may say, and it is curious, to see how much precise majesty there is in that majestic figure of Ludovicus Rex. In the frontispiece, we have endeavored to make the exact calculation. The idea of kingly dignity is equally strong in the two outer figures, and you see, at once, that majesty is made out of the wig, the high-heeled shoes, and cloak, all fleurs de lis bespangled. As for the little lean, shriveled, paunchy old man, of 5'2", in a jacket and breeches, there is no majesty in him at any rate, and yet he has just stepped out of that very suit of clothes. Put the wig and shoes on him, and he is 6 feet high, the other fripperies, and he stands before you majestic, imperial, and heroic. Thus do barbers and cobblers make the gods that we worship. For do we not all worship him? Yes, though we all know him to be stupid, heartless, short, of doubtful personal courage, worship and admire him we must, and have set up, in our hearts, a grand image of him, endowed with wit, magnanimity, valor, and enormous heroical stature. And what magnanimous acts are attributed to him, or, rather, how differently do we view the actions of heroes and common men, and find that the same thing shall be a wonderful virtue in the former, which, in the latter, is only an ordinary act of duty. Look at yonder window of the king's chamber. One morning a royal cane was seen whirling out of it, and plumped among the courtiers and guard of honor below. King Louis had absolutely, and with his own hand, flung his own cane out of the window, because, said he, I won't demean myself by striking a gentleman. Oh, miracle of magnanimity! Lauzun was not caned, because he besought majesty to keep his promise, only imprisoned for 10 years in Pignerol, along with banished Fouquet, and a pretty story is Fouquet's too. Out of the window the king's august head was one day thrust, when old Conde was painfully toiling up the steps of the court below. Don't hurry yourself, my cousin, cries magnanimity, one who has to carry so many laurels cannot walk fast. At which all the courtiers, lackeys, mistresses, chamberlains, Jesuits, and scullions, clasped their hands and burst into tears. Men are affected by the tale to this very day. For a century and quarters. Have not all the books that speak of Versailles or Louis quarters told the story? And hurry yourself, my cousin. O admirable king and Christian! What a pitch of condescension is here, that the greatest king of all the world should go for, to say anything so kind, and really tell a tottering old gentleman, worn out with gout, age, and wounds, not to walk too fast. What a proper fund of slavishness is there in the composition of mankind, that histories like these should be found to interest and awe them. Till the world's end, most likely, this story will have its place in the history books, and unborn generations will read it, and tenderly be moved by it. I am sure that magnanimity went to bed that night, pleased and happy, intimately convinced that he had done an action of sublime virtue, and had easy slumbers and sweet dreams, especially if he had taken a light supper, and not too vehemently attacked his end caused anew it. That famous adventure, in which the end caused anew it, was brought into use, for the sake of one Paquelin alias Molière, how often has it been described and admired? This Paquelin, though king's valet de chamber, was by profession a vagrant, and as such, looked coldly on by the great lords of the palace, who refused to eat with him. Majesty hearing of this, ordered his end caused anew it, to be placed on the table, and positively cut off a wing with his own knife and fork for Paquelin's use. Oh, thrice happy John Baptist! The king has actually sat down with him cheek by jowl, at the liver wing of a fowl, and given Molière the gizzard, put his imperial legs under the same mahogany subiisdum trabibus. A man, after such an honor, can look for little else in this world. He has tasted the utmost conceivable earthly happiness, and has nothing to do now but to fold his arms, look up to heaven, and sing Unc Dimittis and die. Do not let us abuse poor old Louis on account of this monstrous pride, but only lay it to the charge of the fools who believed and worshipped it. If, honest man, he believed himself to be almost a god, it was only because thousands of people had told him, so people only half liars too, who did, in the depths of their slavish respect, admire the man almost as much as they said they did. If, when he appeared in his 500 million coat, as he is said to have done, before the Siamese ambassadors, the courtiers began to shade their eyes and long for parasols, as if this Bourbonic sun was too hot for them. Indeed, it is no wonder that he should believe that there was something dazzling about his person. He had half a million of eager testimonies to this idea. Who was to tell him the truth? Only in the last years of his life, did trembling courtiers dare whisper to him, after much circumlocution, that a certain battle had been fought at a place called Blenheim, and that Eugene and Marlborough had stopped his long career of triumphs. Honest plus hero a noter age, says the old man, to one of his old generals, welcoming Tallard after his defeat, and he rewards him with honors, as if he had come from a victory. There is, if you will, something magnanimous in this welcome to his conquered general, this stout protest against fate. Disaster succeeds disaster. Armies after armies march out to meet fiery Eugene and that dogged, fatal Englishman, and disappear in the smoke of the enemy's cannon. Even at Versailles you may almost hear it roaring at last. But when courtiers, who have forgotten their god, now talk of quitting this grand temple of his, old Louis plucks up heart, and will never hear of surrender. All the gold and silver at Versailles he melts, to find bread for his armies. All the jewels on his 500 million coat he pawns resolutely, and, bidding Villars go, and make the last struggle but one, promises, if his general is defeated, to place himself at the head of his nobles, and die king of France. Indeed, after a man, for 60 years, has been performing the part of a hero, some of the real heroic stuff must have entered into his composition, whether he would or not. When the great Elliston was enacting the part of King George IV, In the playoff, the coronation, at Drury Lane, the galleries applauded very loudly his suavity and majestic demeanor, at which Elliston, inflamed by the popular loyalty and by some fermented liquor in which, it is said, he was in the habit of indulging, burst into tears, and spreading out his arms, exclaimed, bless ye, my people. Don't let us laugh at his Ellistonian majesty, nor at the people who clapped hands and yelled bravo in praise of him. The tipsy old manager did really feel that he was a hero at that moment, and the people, wild with delight and attachment for a magnificent coat and breeches, surely. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.